This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today we're talking about Freemasonry. We've talked about it many times on Dreamland, and the same issue always comes up, and we'll discuss it later on as to the conspiratorial aspects of it, whether or not it's a dangerous secret society, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think so, obviously, or I wouldn't have Masons on the show, and I think very much the contrary. Today we're going to be talking to Mark Stavish. He's an authority on Western spiritual traditions, and I can assure you this is true because he has written 26 books published in 9 languages, including another book which I have also read called The Path of Alchemy. And as you know, we had Prince Stash DiRola, who is a great alchemist, on Dreamland a few weeks ago. And The Path of Alchemy, I think Prince Stash would agree, is a fine book. Egregores, and we can talk about what an egregore is as we get into this, because it's such a mysterious word. He's the founder and director of the Institute for Hermetic Studies and the Louis Claude de Saint-Martin Fund. He has appeared on many shows, including our friendly Coast to Coast AM, which I'm going to be on again soon the next few weeks. Now, he's been on the History Channel, the BBC. He's even been discussed and featured in the New York Times. But that does not necessarily mean he's wrong. Anyway, welcome to the show. I'm so glad to have you with us. And I think we're going to have a wonderful time with The Path of Freemasonry, the craft as a spiritual practice. I would like to start out with a little bit of the history of Freemasonry, because I think you know this story really very well. And why don't you tell us something about the first times it appears in the record, not the legends, but in the record?
Wow, that's a question in and of itself, because that's always being revised. I think what we do, and I like to show this, is we look to the founding of the United Grand Lodge of England, and that was in 1717. Now, what that means is to have a United Grand Lodge meant that there had to be other lodges prior. And if I remember correctly, even the date, now think about that, that's 300 years ago, but even that date of 1717 may have been recently revised to 1715, I think, because of some records. So this notion of when is the first Masonic lodge, and when we talk about Masonic lodge, we're thinking as in Freemasonic, that's pretty much anyone's guess, because there's a period of transition when we're going from what are called operative lodges, that is lodges, which are essentially union halls of men who work in stone, to these kind of philosophical lodges where they're opening the doors to anybody. You know, they're going to let anybody in this club. And it's folks who are interested in what Masons do. Well, that's the question. Why are these hoity-toity folks and even, you know, a lot of what we have as professionals and middle-class folks, why are they interested in what Masons do? What is the Masonic secret? What are they after? And many people have come to believe, and I am among them, that it was mathematics, geometry in particular, and the fact that these men could travel. So they had news of other places.
So, yeah, and they were literally, when we say Masons, they were they were craftsmen, essentially.
Correct. Correct.
What about the Regis manuscript from the 15th century, as I recall, that refers to masonry as a craft, doesn't it?
Yes, and we see it because a lot of these manuscripts do refer to the craft in terms of a physical craft, as in to create or manufacture or produce something. But remember, within that framework, there's always a certain philosophical view of where one fits into the cosmos. None of these crafts existed as we think of them today. If someone says they're a writer, I always refer to them as a child of Hermes. And often they look at me confused. Well, you know, if you're a writer, Hermes is your patron deity. That's your god. Same if you're in banking or finance. So if you were to look at any of these crafts, each of them had their own patron saint, because the world was still a somewhat mysterious and we could even say metaphysical place. So you as a craftsman would have a patron saint, you'd have patron holidays to that saint, and you would have a place in God's universe.
And this is what they lived for and what they built the Gothic cathedrals for, is this place in the universe. Is that true? Is that an accurate way of describing the way these people who were craftspeople thought of themselves in those days?
I can't say it was universal, but more of them probably did than now. And the reason is very simple. They were imbued in a metaphysical worldview from the time of their birth to the time of their death. I think one of the finest documentaries on this is a movie that's probably 30 years old now called Cathedral. And it's a partially animated, partially live production, and it talks about the production of a cathedral, but it also shows the worldview they lived in. And of course, you know, the churches weren't always filled with holy men. There was corruption as well, and there was shakedown for money.
There still is. That hasn't changed.
Right. You know, and that shakedown for money was to finance some of these cathedrals. But at the same time, that aside, there was a tremendous amount of devotion and a tremendous amount of piety at different times. So we see people looking at their work, and within that framework of that work, a sense of connectedness to something bigger. And this is really important, because that bigger was cosmological. It was sacred. It was divine. And we see that's probably one of the biggest things missing today, is people looking for a connection. Now, they look for a connection, but where do they find it? How do they find that connection to something bigger?
Well, exactly. And this is a big part of what this show is about, because this is a show that goes to people who are on spiritual journeys and exploring spiritual journeys, many of whom have been turned on to this by extraordinary and unusual events in their lives, like I had, that sparked the writing of Communion and my entire spiritual journey that has taken place since. So, you know, we're very open to this, but we keep the experiential side of our lives to ourselves, pretty much. And I'm not going to go into that here, because this is not your area of expertise, but what is the journey itself. And I want to ask you, before we go on too much, a little bit about your own journey, where you started in Masonry and why it became so important in your life.
Well, I joined Masonry about 20 years ago. I'm shy of celebrating my 20th anniversary of being entered, passed, and raised. And it came to me because I was running an esoteric group, and we were having quite a few folks coming in from New York and Philadelphia to it. The group was in northeastern Pennsylvania and just south of Scranton. And quite a few of the folks were Masons. And they always asked me why I never joined. And I said, well, I just haven't gotten around to it yet, and whatever excuse I could make. And then finally, one of them, who was a very good friend, I said, well, okay, you've made your point. I've put in my petition to a lodge, and they all came in for it, and we made a great couple of nights of it. So my entranceway to Freemasonry was very different. It came in by way of, well, not so much different now, different then. Now we see more young men joining Freemasonry because they're looking for something esoteric. I was not. I just wanted to have the Masonic experience to see what that was all about, and it's quite worthwhile, by the way. However, we see more young men entering it because of a belief in an esoteric view and esoteric teachings. A lot of it has to do with Dan Brown, even though that itself is going on 20 years. That has a lot to do with it. At the same time, that is part of the Masonic revival movement that's happening, that the chicken dinner, fish fry, and as terrible as this sounds, but terribly average view that we see in many Masonic lodges and Anglo-Saxon Masonry is fortunately giving way to a more vital Masonry, which is more philosophic, more esoteric, and in that way, much more in line with its 18th century origins, European origins.
I know that there are two streams in Masonry. When I was a boy, I was a Catholic, and we were not supposed to join the Masons, which is probably what made me interested in them. And I met and talked to some Masons who were in my hometown of San Antonio, and it was very much the fish fry kind of thing. And it was also segregated, both men only and whites only. And that was true, I guess, in a lot of lodges in the South, but it wasn't congenial to me even when I was young. Especially the whites only thing was not acceptable to me. And I know that's no longer true at all, but I also want to ask you about, as the craft moves back into its original form, which is a philosophical organization devoted to basically to inner search in pursuit of ways of serving the good on the externally. What about women? I know that the core Masonry is still males only. Where do we go here? Where are we going to take this?
Well, there's really nowhere to go. And the reason for that is simple. What is called regular Masonry is a man's only organization for a variety of reasons. At the same time, there is co-Masonry, which is of men and women. There's Droit Humain. There are some only female groups of Masonic groups. The question is size. These are often smaller organizations. And can I, as a regular Mason, associate with them? Well, there were times when, if you did, it would be pretty much instant ejection. Now, people don't really care so much. There's more of an ask, don't tell. But the problem is, when we talk about Masonry, we're talking about a very large tent. So within the United States alone, we're talking maybe 51 grand lodges. Yeah. I want to think about that. You know, it's not as if you can say there is a Masonic singularity imprimatur like you would have with from the Catholic Church. It's not that monolithic. So, you know, even within Masonry, there's considerable differences. So what we have are landmarks, and those landmarks are what we identify with both nationally and internationally as something being regular Masonry. I don't really see any reason for regular Masonry to change. It doesn't have to, because if people want to, I encourage them. I actively do this. And look, grandmasters read my books. I mean, there's no secret to my stance on this. I'm very vocal about it. We need more philosophical Masonry. We need to more traditional observance lodges. And we need to be more open. And that means if members of regular Masonry want to join, you know, Droit Humain or Co-Masonry or something else, they need to feel free to without any repercussions. And, of course, that changes from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And often people don't tell. People know. They just don't care anymore. It's not a big deal. So I think some of that view, there's what's on the books versus what really happens. There's bigger concerns than whether someone is going to another lodge like that. But those lodges are free to grow themselves. I think that's my point. They're also free to grow themselves.
Right. I understand. We're talking to Mark Stavish, his new book, The Path of Freemasonry, The Craft as a Spiritual Practice. His blog is Vox Hermes. And where would we find your blog?
Oh, just Google it. It's at WordPress. And
we just Google VOXHERMES and we get there, right?
Correct. Or just Google my name. You'll get lots of stuff. And Institute for Hermetic Studies, Google that too.
Well, Free Dreamlanders will be back in a moment. And before we go, subscribers, I would like to ask all of you to tell your friends about Unknown Country and Dreamland, because we need subscribers. The COVID situation has caused our new subscriptions to drop way off. And so if you have friends who are interested and you think who may benefit from this wonderful website and its content and Dreamland in particular, please let them know, suggest to them, or you can give them a gift. Just go to your account and click on gifts and you can do that. Free Dreamlanders, we'll be right back. Before we left the air, Mark held up a wonderful coffee cup. We all need to see it. Can you hold it up again?
It's sealing it.
There she is, the owl, symbol of many things. Can you talk a little bit about her? About the owl?
Oh, geez, it's so much. It's really all the great, deep, dark, and mysterious things of the night. Of the unconscious and those psychic forces. That's my understanding of it. And also, the owl is misunderstood. The owl is a terrific predatory bird. So it's also those really deep, aggressive forces within us that we need to survive in the darkness, that we need to survive in the unconscious realm as we bring it into consciousness. So that's the way I look at the owl. And I just love it. I think owls are really fascinating birds, fascinating creatures.
Well, of course, those of us who are in the close encounter experience are deeply involved with the owl, because our experience, my first initiation into this journey that I'm on, started with a confused memory of an owl. And this is commonplace in this experience, which is not necessarily about alien contact. It's about externalizing an inner search in the context of some very powerful questions, I would think. But in any case, we really share your recognition of the owl, and this goes all the way back in human history. Athena's, the great goddess of Athens, she was both the goddess of wisdom and the goddess of battle. And her symbol was the owl for that reason, because the owl is both a predator and a source of wisdom. All right. Now, in the book, I want you to explain the book a little bit, because the book is a really useful tool. It's not just I don't want to give the impression to my listeners that this is just sort of another history of masonry. This is a tool that you can use whether you want to be a mason or not. Now you emphasize that in the book. Can you tell us exactly why it is that you explain that it's useful to anyone?
Well, the book was written to help Masons in many ways better understand Masonry, because depending on which jurisdiction you're in, you may not have a good education on that. Education can simply become a matter of learning rituals, and that's about it. So that was one aspect of the book, and as I was writing it, what I've noticed is what I'm really talking about is a worldview, a path of self-development. How do we improve ourselves? And within Masonry, we talk about the seven liberal arts and sciences, or the trivium and quadrivium. And what do they mean to us today? Well, when we think about it, all of these things are useful. How do we learn to reason or logic? How do we learn to speak or rhetoric? How do we learn about our place in the cosmos, which is astrology or astronomy, depending on who you look at? What is the importance of geometry? Well, you know, everything we have is because of geometry. The technology we have, the buildings we're in, all of this is a function of geometry on some level. So better understanding yourself and your place in the universe is really what masonry has the potential to offer you. But it's not just masonry. You don't have to be a Freemason to have this inquisitive and explorative worldview. So when I wrote the book, I took it through, you know, what are symbols and rituals and the ideas. And then I asked questions and I gave suggested readings and exercises you could do. And one of the most interesting ones is having to do with how does one memorize all these different ideas? Well, we've heard of the art of memory and how you identify ideas with symbols and lock them into a physical place. Others is how you would draw them on the ground in chalk for the ritual work. This is something we all can adapt to our own lives in our own unique way, so that we can better explore what it means to be human. What does it mean to be myself? And how do I improve myself? Because at the end of the day, Freemasonry asks one question. And it occurs in what's known as the Chamber of Reflection. It's a very famous aspect of Freemasonry that isn't always used anymore. But I encourage your listeners to Google it and see some images of the Chamber of Reflection. Because it asks one question, why do you want to join Masonry? Well, when I give a presentation on it, I change that to, why are you here?
That's because a much bigger question.
But it fits within the Masonic context, because when the Chamber of Reflection was used, being a Freemason was a death sentence in some countries.
Yes.
So why are you here? Why do you want to join this organization? And that's where it begins to expand into that much bigger question. Why are you here? Why are you in this lodge tonight? Why are you with this group? Why are you on this planet? Why are you here? And that's the question we need to ask and answer for ourselves.
Of course, underlying that question is the great question from the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. Know thyself. Know thyself. A remarkable question. And how do we find the answer? That is, I think that's the basic path of Masonry that you're talking about, in a sense. And I thought to myself as I was reading the book that the journey toward the good is the journey of self-understanding, because you have to know yourself in order to know how to project yourself in the world as an advocate of the good. So,
well, I think that's it. Know thyself. And this is what the younger men coming into Masonry want. They want the philosophical and esoteric aspects, because they want to know, they want the answer to that question. How do I begin to know myself? And in the book, The Path of Freemasonry, we explore that within the Masonic context, but by no means is it exclusively Masonic. It is a human experience, and it is how that human experience was particularly realized in Western culture and within the Western framework over the last 300 or so years, or slightly more years. So really since the Renaissance, from the Renaissance on. So it is really to help us reinvent ourselves. The book is a way of how to help us reinvent ourselves and, in some respects, our sense of culture with it.
Yeah, when you say our sense of culture with it, what do you mean exactly? That's a very interesting statement in the context of our discussion.
Well, we have different cultures. I mean, we often think of our culture today in terms of just what we see when we go out, whether it's Walmart or McDonald's or something of that nature, or what we see on Netflix or Amazon. That's in some ways culture, and it's a pop culture, and it's immediacy culture, but there's cultures of longevity. And there's our own culturation. Do you consider yourself a cultured person that is refined, intentional? Culture is intentional. And I think that's a good way to describe it. We are making decisions which we have thought about. Remember, logic and reason and rhetoric. We've discussed them. We've contemplated them. We've considered their cause and effect. What is the effect of this in the future? And I undertake this action because I believe it will be in my best interest. And it can be something as simple as forming good habits or wearing the right clothes to an interview. One of the most fascinating things we see about Masonry is that for many young men, it is the first time they've been required to wear a suit and tie to anything.
Yeah, I know. I used to wear suits and ties everywhere, and now I don't anymore. They've gone out of style.
But they love it.
I agree.
Because it says this is special.
Right.
This is important. I need to pay attention to how I project myself into the world. Because now how I project myself is a reflection of how I think about myself. I mean, Freemasonry is really in many ways the earliest continuing education self-help movement. I mean, it really had those qualities to it for generations.
If a young man or young woman, or older man or woman for that matter, wants to join Masonry now, but not the fish fry Masonry, the Masonry mm-hmm. you're talking about, where do they start?
Well, that's a little difficult, and I'll tell you why. First of all, women are going to have the advantage, and because if they join co-masonry, which is or something like that, there are other variations of it. But I think if they go to if they Google co-masonry and they go to the official website for it, which is in Colorado, they'll see a list of different associated Masonic groups that are very esoteric in nature. So they're going to have a certain advantage. I'll tell you that. They're a higher demand organization in many ways. And men can join that too as well. If a young man is joining Masonry, he's going to have a little bit of a trouble because he's going to have to look around in his jurisdiction and he's going to have to find a lodge that he's comfortable with. But he probably will not find everything he's looking for. And then within that jurisdiction, he's going to have to reach out and find where the traditional observance lodge is and probably have dual membership. However, for myself in Pennsylvania, let me say, we only have two of them, one near Allentown, one near Pittsburgh, neither of which are extremely close to me, although Allentown is closer. And what we have is a tremendous educational program. The Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania, and of course any Mason can join this regardless of jurisdiction, they have a tremendous educational program that you can do online. And twice a year, they have the Academy of Knowledge, which I spoke at. And those are very esoteric in terms of presentation. So the philosophical and esoteric aspects are there. You're just going to have to look for it a little bit. And of course, and I've been brought to task for this, but I'll say it more in a more informed way. Generally speaking, the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite, of which Arthur Hoyas wrote the introduction to my book, is a spectacularly educated organization. They are phenomenal.
And where is it when you say southern?
That's located in Washington, D.C. and covers 35 states, I believe. Then there's Northern Jurisdiction, which is out of Massachusetts, which I'm in. It covers, I believe, 15 states. The problem was for many years, Northern Jurisdiction was not very philosophical. It wasn't very demanding. I understand that the current Grand Master, friends of mine who've been raised to 33s have told me the current Grand Master has a great educational program. I've gone online to look at it. So our jurisdiction is turning around. My point is, if you are a young man or an older man and you are in Freemasonry and you want to meet up with other men who have philosophical, esoteric interests, you may not necessarily meet them in your lodge, but I guarantee you it will not take that long to find them in other lodges and in other activities if you just know which words to look for and go online, because the internet has made so much of Masonry accessible to other Masons, not just non-Masons, but Mason to Mason communication is just booming, and in a really good way. Yes, there's always some troublemakers. You know that. There's always someone who's always unhappy and complains. I'm not talking about that. I've met just wonderful, wonderful people, courtesy of exchanges that we otherwise would not have had from social media or email.
Well, we live in such a time of deep division that we have to learn how to live with one another. And I have friends on every side of the part of the political spectrum, and I'm always, and my website, of course, is not political. And it's, I mean, spiritual search isn't political. You can be a spiritual searcher. G.I. Gurdjieff had in his group in Paris in the 1940s, there were both Jews and Nazis, and they worked together very successfully inside the group. And after the war, because he had had connections to these Nazis, he was about to be condemned as a collaborator, until they discovered that he had also protected Jews and saved a number of them from being deported. So we are, what I'm saying here is, we are above this. Our work is above the whole political spectrum. All spiritual search is. It simply isn't part of politics. Politics comes and goes, but we're still here and still asking that same question of ourselves. Know thyself. Mark's book is The Path of Freemasonry. His, I guess, blog is Vox Hermes, VOXHERMES. You can engage with him on his blog, or better, get the book, and because the book will take you through the whole process, the beginning of learning this great tradition. Free Dreamlanders, we'll be right back. There are wonderful groups of questions in the book, and I'd like to, this first set is taken from material by Charles Mertz. And who was Charles Mertz? He wrote a book called Ask Me, Brother.
Well, that I can't answer. I read his book, but it's not his biography.
Okay. Well, obviously, he knew a lot.
Yeah.
He had, and I'm sure you, what you can do is enlighten us about these, some of these wonderful questions. Now, these are questions about not the actual known origins of Masonry, but about its traditional or legendary origins. But they're very important to anyone who is interested in Masonry as a spiritual practice and a philosophical practice. And I'm going to just go through a few of them, beginning with, I guess the best way to talk about it is the significance of Alexandria. He starts, that's his first question. And what is it about Alexandria that's so important in Masonry, in esoteric Masonry?
You know, when you look at Freemasonry, almost all of the rituals, particularly those which we consider Blue Lodge or entered fellow craft and master mason, entered apprentice, fellow craft, master mason, those degrees focus around the building of the Temple of Solomon. So the building of the Temple of Solomon is the focal point of so much of what we do. But in other Masonic degrees that are after that, which are considered explanatory degrees or exploratory degrees of the Masonic concepts, we see other ideas brought in. One of my favorites was always the Tower of Babel, But you also see Alexandria and Egypt. And of course, because the men who were writing these degrees were often very well educated, and they understood the importance of Egypt within the classical framework. So Egypt was seen as the place of all wisdom. And of course, we're here having this on the Feast of the Epiphany, which is the Three Kings Day. It is the day when my great uncle, who was deeply involved in occultism and esotericism, he was born in 1900. And of course, the three kings brought three gifts to the newborn Jesus child, Christ child. There are different stories that say after that, when of course Herod was going to slay the children, of course we call that the slaughter of the innocents, that Mary and Joseph and Jesus fled to Egypt. And that you see wonderful paintings coming out of the Belle Epoque of Mary and Jesus resting between the paws of the Sphinx. So this association of Egypt with wisdom and magic and esotericism is deeply rooted in the Western framework. And of course, the Greeks and from that others believe that everything great came from Egypt. And of course, the Hermetic revival, not revival, because it was the origins of Hermeticism, take place in Alexandria when we see the last surviving aspects of the Egyptian temple period, Gnosticism, some variations of Jewish mysticism, early Christianity, probably even some Buddhism and some Indian yogas or tantras in some form, all mixing together in Alexandria and creating this wonderful thing we would later call Hermeticism in its various forms. So Alexandria is very important for that, the notion of a center of learning and of great wisdom.
How would you describe Hermeticism?
Hermeticism is the survival of classical Egyptian beliefs into the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, having a period of revival in the late 19th, early 20th century to the present. And those beliefs we consider or focus primarily around practices of alchemy, astrology, and to some degree Kabbalah, but what we think of as ceremonial magic or esoteric or ritualistic practices.
And you engage in these practices?
That is correct.
I don't want to disturb, I know some of this is probably private, but I'm not trying to pry, but at the same time, what of these practices work for you, and what energies do you gain from them? And I know it's a general question, but it has to be, because I'm not sure exactly what you do.
Oh, well, sure. Well, first of all, we have to understand energy is the key to everything. If we don't have the juice, we don't get anything done. So it's really understanding what is that relationship between energy consciousness and matter, or energy consciousness and symbols, or like with astrology, it's consciousness, energy, and cycles. So we're always in some way trying to engage what is this relationship between energy and awareness, and then how does that fit in? So whenever we engage in any kind of meditative practices or visualization practices, we're engaging in that aspect of energy consciousness and symbols to some degree. Okay, even if it's not symbolic in the traditional sense as we think of it, but something even very literal and concrete, it's imaginative for us. So it allows us to enter into or engage the unconscious in the imaginal realm. And that imaginal realm, at least if we look at the great Renaissance practitioners, particularly Giordano Bruno, that is the gateway to everything. The imaginal realm is that hinge point, that porch point between the inner and the outer realms.
I was going to bring up Giordano Bruno when you talked about memory, because, of course, he has left behind an amazing system of memory where you can use it and their evolutions of it to build a very, very good memory. Now, Bruno was murdered by the Catholic Church. Can you tell us a little bit about Giordano Bruno, and his importance?
Well, you know, he's a figure that people should at least be superficially aware of, because he played a pivotal role in cosmology. And the general belief is that his execution by the Inquisition in burning alive was done because of his cosmological views rather than so-called religious views. And that may be an area that is something for scholars to nitpick about or to examine. It may not necessarily be something the average person finds important today, but at that time it was critical. And I think that's important to understand. At that time, it was an important notion. What he left us in terms of what the listener, your average listener, can be interested in is this notion of the role of memory and the imagination. And he kept alive the classical art of memory. And the art of memory is, how do we remember things? And of course, the classical orator, and we said in masonry, the ability to speak properly and to speak at length is an important part of the work, as is memorizing these extensive rituals that we have to learn. And they're often learned from mouth to ear. You don't have a script to go from in some instances. So you hear someone say it, and then you have to learn it and repeat it back and go through that process. So memory is very important. And memory is really the key to our existence. It's what allows us to, when we say someone is intelligent, what we're really saying is they have a good memory for the most part. they remember a lot of ideas and facts and can possibly then re-coordinate them into new possibilities or effective solutions. So his art of memory is very important. But with it was the role of the imagination. In the post-Reformation period, we see the notion of the, or the importance of the imagination being degraded and distrusted. Whereas imagination prior to that was the key to the invisible realms. You see it in all of the magical texts. We see we see that in all new thought. We see that in New Age thinking. We see that in Tibetan Vajrayana. We see that in Indian Tantra. How we utilize our imagination decides and defines who we are and what we become.
Now, you're going to have to expand on that, but you're going to have to do it after our final break, Free Dreamlanders. We're talking to Mark Stavish, the path of Freemasonry, the craft as a spiritual practice, and we're beginning to go quite deep into this whole realm of the craft and its spiritual significance. Whether you're a man or a woman, you can explore the craft, and we've talked about that a little bit. You can also reach Mark on his blog, Vox Hermes. And just before we continue on, can you repeat a little bit about how to engage with the craft? I know we've said it before, but I want to say it again, just so that people who are thinking about it have it in their minds.
Well, to engage with the physical aspect of the craft would require contacting a Masonic entity from men. That would mostly be what we call regular masonry, a local lodge or a grand lodge in your area. For women, it would mean probably going online and looking up something like co-masonry or female Masonic lodges and connecting with those and finding out one where one is locally and getting involved. And that's the physical connection. The spiritual connection, the deep philosophical connection comes through the procedures outlined in the path of Freemasonry, in which we begin to look at what is the role of symbolism in our lives? What is the role of architecture? What is the role of the environment we're creating for our mind and body? And then how does that affect us? And that is in some ways a reflection of what we would have seen in both Indian art of placement or Chinese feng shui. We see that in the Renaissance with the notion of How do we create specific environments for specific outcomes? Ficino was big on that in his three books of life. The environment we create physically becomes a expression of our inner life. It affects our inner life. What we expose ourselves to changes who we are to some degree. Therefore, we have to be very careful and selective in those things we expose ourselves to. And that's what I mentioned earlier about the notion of culture and creating an inner culture. At the same time, we can use our mind to create possibilities. If we don't always have something available to us in the outer world, we can always create it within our inner world through the power of imagination and bring it to reality at some point in the future. So the power of creativity and doing so in a manner that is harmonious and beneficial to ourselves and to others and allows us to become a building block, a smooth ashlar, if you will, in the temple of deity for the benefit of all beings is what Masonry is about.
In the temple of deity for the benefit of all beings. What an interesting, complex statement. When you say the temple of deity, what do you mean?
Well, in Freemasonry, we use the term grand architect of the universe. And that can have different meanings. There's only one Masonic entity that does not require belief in a supreme being, and that is the French Grand Orient. The others have some kind of litmus test. The question is, what does a supreme being mean to you? And therein lies one of the great questions. It's a very personal answer. So you're asked, do you believe in the existence of a supreme being? Well, okay, yes, I do. But you're never asked, what does that mean?
I have studied the Templars extensively. And I think that what they brought out of Egypt, out of the temple in Jerusalem, was probably a system of architecture from the classical world that was used, I would think, in the creation of temples, especially such temples as the Temple of Athena on the Acropolis in Athens, which is as esoteric a design as anything in any architecture in the Western world, and that this evolved into the skills necessary to build the cathedrals. And paralleling this practical level of knowledge, which would have been a level of mathematics and geometry that had been lost in the West at that point, is a spiritual journey that is like the journey that emerges out of the Gospel of Thomas, which is a hidden mathematical journey, very much. It doesn't seem like it on the surface, and it's got a lot of different surfaces, that particular gospel. But what role does this play in our journey toward the divine? Because I know you have some very interesting responses to this question. What is the math of the sacred, and how do we find it in our lives?
Well, one of the somewhere it said in the beginning, God geometrized. You know, God used geometry in the beginning. You know, we go from 1 to 2 to 3, and we have a whole series of various numerological schools telling us what these numbers mean and how they relate to us. We see them symbolically related, both in terms of ritual structure format, but also into whole philosophical and ideological statements, whether it be the Trinity as it exists in Christianity or in other forms, whether it be the 10 spheres of the Tree of Life, or whether it be the seven planets, And then how do these relate to us as individuals? Because remember, the ancients were looking for this notion of as above, so below, microcosm and macrocosm. How do I relate to the cosmic? So, you know, you had five fingers on each hand. So each one of the fingers had an aspect of an element as well as a planet. All of this has to do with a deep cosmological view. Well, as a walking temple, that is, an individual being is a walking temple, that individual being would unite with other beings and create things, might build a house, might build a church, whatever. And in that creation, some of these philosophical ideas would always seep through. Okay. Whether, you know, in terms of what does this represent? So we see the use of numbers, both in a very practical sense of measurement, of measure and order, but also that order then is expected to reflect a divine order, some kind of divine harmony. And that's why when we look at classical structures, when we look at these classical buildings, these churches built during the post non-apocalyptic frenzy of the 10th century, you know, that, and of which notice how so many of them are Notre Dame, they're to Our Lady, to the Mother of God. That's a very important point to note.
And also more deeply to Mother Earth, perhaps.
Yes, they're built often over sacred wells or sacred sites of some kind.
Right.
There's a rich history within those that we see talked about in the 20th century by Fulcanelli, the anonymous Francophone, we're not sure if he actually was French, but Francophone alchemist who wrote The Mystery of the Cathedrals. And how does the symbolism of the cathedrals relate to the alchemical process? So all of that required an understanding of harmony and number and formation. So numerology had a very practical sense in terms of measurement, but it was understood not just as kind of a symbolic way as we might today, like what's the number of your name, but in terms of a very real expression of the presence of deity, of divine force in this physical world.
Of divine force in this physical world. You know, I've always thought of the temples and the cathedrals in the same sense, is that they are intended to connect us, the intelligence of the earth to the higher level. As above, so below, between them are these temples and these sacred places all over the world. And the sense of a lost world is always there, because if you look at the very oldest sacred sites on earth, the ones that have been inhabited the longest, you find them on a geodesic line that doesn't point directly north. It points to a direction about 1,450 miles west of a current true north, as if once the planet wasn't askew. Once it was, things were different, and now they are askew, but we can find balance, and maybe this is all about finding balance. Now, I want to return briefly to the three gifts of the Magi, which are a very important concept because they relate to the trilateral name of God, and this is one of the questions in Mr. Mertz's Ask Me Brother, the group of questions you published of his. And I think it's a very important one. The sounding of Aum, for example, can you tell us a little bit about that and the significance of the trilateral name of God? This is a deep show because a lot of people on this show are really deeply into spiritual journeys. So I'm sorry if I'm these questions are a little more challenging than you have received before.
No, this is a great one because it really puts Mertz and Masonry at that time in its cultural place.
Yeah.
These were well-educated men. These were well-learned men. And if you take a look at the various Masonic encyclopedias from the period, they are deeply written and deeply filled with esotericism. And a lot of these folks were coming out of the occult revival period. They were knowledgeable in theosophy. There was an explosion of interest in Eastern philosophy at that time. Particularly Vivekananda was well known. And into the 20s, we began to see Yogananda. So there was a deep knowledge and appreciation of Eastern philosophical views, which, of course, was primarily yoga oriented. Not, they really had no knowledge of Tibetan or Chinese views at that time. So Aum, of course, becomes the mantra that you see a lot of Indian swamis are using to begin to bridge that gap, because they talk about the four sounds of Aum. There's ah, ooh, em, and then silence. So we talk about, you know, the nature of deity, the three aspects of the Trinity. So it becomes a bridge point for philosophical discussion. Now, of course, you're going to find many professors of theology and comparative religion who will dismiss these points, but the practitioners were unconcerned about that. The practitioners were looking at how to make sense of this on a personal and internal level. So Masonry, if we look carefully at it, is also one of the earliest forms of comparative religious studies. And in the late 19th and early
statement.
Yes. And in the late 19th and early 20th century, this becomes very prominent because, well, all we have to do is look at the writings of Albert Pike.
Yes, tell us.
Albert.
Wait a minute, folks. I have bad news and good news. Good news for subscribers is this is going to get really interesting in a few minutes. It's been interesting all along, but we're going to go very much deeper in the next half hour. The bad news is for you free dreamlanders. Now's your chance to make the decision. Subscribe to Unknown Country, and you can stay with us through the whole show and not listen to a single ad. Free dreamlanders, goodbye for today. Subscribers will keep right on keeping on. All right, I really interrupted you, and I apologize.
It's all right.
So go ahead and just let's pick up the thread again.
So if we look at Albert Pike, and Albert Pike, of course, has gotten a lot of press in the last year and a half, often a misunderstood character, but he was a genius. And if we look at his principal book, Morals and Dogma, which has a pretty strange title, it's never really quite clear to me. I don't remember having anyone explain to me why it's called that, but it is essentially a look at each of the 32 Masonic degrees in Scottish Rite Freemasonry, and looking at it from a deeply philosophical and esoteric view. And at that time, he uses the literature which is available to him. And this is really important because a lot of us, until recently, were still using much of this literature. He is pulling on the French occultist Eliphas Levy. He's pulling upon some of the writings of Blavatsky. He's pulling upon a host of comparative views. So he's trying to show the universality of Masonic ideas and idealism, that while it is brought up within the framework of Judeo-Christianity, it is not exclusive to that. And within that framework, then, he is building an understanding of Masonry as a deep spiritual path and a custodian of a spiritual path as well. Maybe not necessarily all of the technical aspects, but of the philosophical ideas. Because within the framework of Masonry at that point, Masonry is now a tool or a mechanism that will help establish a kind of worldwide brotherhood. And this is where we get into some of the issues where we talk about Masonic conspiracies. You know, this wasn't something that it was actively doing, like seeking out to create, laws or governance or that type of thing, but through inspiration, through the inspiration of the individual, through the individual acculturating themselves and becoming better and understanding that many of these ideas which they had fought over and which they had killed over or discriminated intensely over were not as different as they thought. And we need to understand, because it is so, even though it was only 100 and maybe 40, 50 years ago, it was still very different from our time today, and that the church was still very hostile. That is, the Roman church was still very hostile to Freemasonry. There were certain Protestant sects that were very hostile to Freemasonry, and you see many groups who were having very narrow sectarian views. And not that having a narrow view, it can't be useful. It can be to help you stay focused in your direction. You don't want to just be a jack of all trades, master of none. But there has to be an openness to the possibility of other values or other views, not just saying, well, my way or the highway.
And well, that's a bad human habit. We are my way or the highway is all the way. Most of us, and we have to be very careful about that.
Right, and it happens in Masonry today. I mean, usually on an administrative level when you're dealing with people in groups, not on a philosophical one. But therein lies where we get into some of the idealism of Masonry. It was extremely high at that point. Very, very high ideal, high demand organization.
So we have a situation where there's a lot of persecution, and we haven't really touched on that. Let's talk about a little bit about the objections that the Catholic Church had to Masonry, and as you said, some Protestant sects, but it was primarily Catholic, and it emerges probably, I think, out of the destruction of the Knights Templar and the claims that the dead head, Baphomet, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, was somehow a pagan symbol or a pagan god, even. What was going on there? I mean, besides the Emperor Philip of King Philip of France wanting the Templars' money, there was something deeper in that the church went along with him for its own theological reasons.
Well, the Templars are a tricky issue because, you know, they were, of course, a document arose, what was it, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, saying that they were cleared of all charges of heresy. So they're a tricky issue, and there's probably a very good chance that they had extensive communication with different Islamic esoteric sects in Lebanon, particularly the Druze. And, of course, they had their banking system and tremendous wealth. But at this point, the Templars are the Templars, and we don't have an entity known as Freemasonry.
Right.
What we see within Freemasonry, which is coming on later, remember, roughly 1717 with the Grand Lodge, and so you figure maybe 30, 50 years earlier for other lodges that we can maybe trace and then further back as well. And within that framework, you have several things going on. One is you have men meeting in private without regards to the religious nature of their, well, first of all, they believe in a supreme being, which is considered religious, whether it is or isn't. And they're not asking you, do you belong to this group or that group? So you have Protestants, you have Catholics, and say in Pennsylvania with the Grand Lodge here, you had Jews. So you have the major Abrahamic faiths as they would have been in Europe at that time. Are being represented in these lodges. And no one's really certain what's going on, and they're electing their own officers, and they're kind of making decisions as equals. This is kind of an early form of democratic and government within that structure. We see that replicated later on, during the American Revolution, when the American government is being formed. The United States government. So I think that the concern over Freemasonry was simply, what are they doing in there? We don't know. We're not in control. And then, of course, there's the nature of you're sitting in a building with Protestants, with Jews. That's tricky.
Right.
And not to put too harsh of a framework on it, but because I don't think people today really understand the degree of the philosophical severity that existed at different points and times in places that Freemasonry was dealing with. So I think it had more to do with that, just fear, just a generalized fear. And then, of course, people mishear things. They misunderstand what's being said because the symbolism is involved. And that extrapolates. You had the anti-Masonic movement in the United States in the mid-19th century. That had tremendous damage to Masonry.
What was that movement? Tell us about it.
Oh, boy. I got to really look more of that up. It's there was just a view that secret societies were dangerous to the early government and that they needed to be reined in. And of course, Freemasonry would have been the principal secret society of the time, or semi-secret. I mean, sorry, what do you mean by secret? It's not like you didn't know who was a member. You knew where they met. They often met above a tavern. There's cartoons lampooning them even back then. So it's not as if when we say a secret society, it's not like the mafia. It's not like where you really, really don't know who's in and who isn't. It just had to do with they're doing something we don't know about. And I see this today. A lot of people want to know what's going on. And I say, well, go join a lodge if you want to know what's going on. Well, that's not the truth. Well, wait a minute. You're not a member. So how do you know if it's the truth or not? Because you watched a YouTube video, right? Yeah, I got you. And I think we see later on when we see the types of men. I mean, for example, Masonry has a mixed history of not always reporting reporting itself properly. It sanitizes its own history to be acceptable to the very middle class views, bourgeois views of many people. For example, the Mellon family, which is a very successful family in Pittsburgh and part of the banking industry, many of them were Masons and were quite proud of them. But what you don't see mentioned is their donation to Yale of an extensive collection of books and manuscripts on alchemy and the occult.
Yeah, interesting.
So
I'm going to ask for Mellon about that. He's a friend of mine. Not a friend, yeah, but an acquaintance.
So what we see is this constant desire on Masonry to be very, at least in the United States, I want to be clear on this, on North American Masonry. We see this constant desire to be very socially acceptable because of that anti-Masonic period. And that affects us terribly. Not so much in European Masonry, but where they keep a different view.
The French Masons don't even require belief in a supreme being, as I think you mentioned earlier. So the European Masonry is very different. Can you tell us a little bit about the differences? I think European Masonry, well, go ahead. You tell us about the differences.
Well, there's various French Grand Lodges. There's not just one. The one I mentioned was the Grand Orient. That's not true with other, like I think the National French Grand Lodge that requires belief in a supreme being. The Grand Orient doesn't. Most of those lodges have kept a fairly high requirements, which some could be seen as discriminatory on a socioeconomic level. But at the same time, there is a stronger philosophical view for the most part, although not exclusively. Remember, each lodge is going to be different and lodges change over time as membership changes. It's going to be fairly easier to see the esoteric and encounter esoteric cross membership in different lodges. For example, if you belong to Memphis Mizraim, Egyptian Masonry, which is clearly esoteric, that wouldn't be a problem. But if I were to join Memphis Mizraim here in the U.S., that might cause problems. Okay.
I see.
It might. It would have to be for certain. So it's you get into certain complicated politics, but it's safe to say that generally European continental Masonry, has always kept a closer connection to its esoteric roots.
Now, why would it be a problem here? Explain what it is first that you mentioned it just a moment ago.
Well, it's simply a matter of how groups recognize one another. Again, it's some bizarre political statements about someone. We have landmarks, and again, one of those landmarks is about men being Masons and not women because of the time frame in which it was done and the fact that it was generally connected to older physical labor. Okay, and part of the rituals. There's a certain ritual nudity, you know, the bearing of the breast, okay, that's involved in the first degree. So that would be inappropriate for a woman to do.
Okay, I can see where mixed rituals like that would be awkward.
Right. It has a potential. So what you end up with is then trying to resolve a lot of these issues, especially during the explosion in the 18th century in Europe, when there was just this explosion of degrees and rites. Many of them had only lasted 10 or 15 years, maybe less. Others continued on for generations. And they get amalgamated and absorbed into various other degrees and rites, just like anything does. And then you end up with, well, okay, you know, if you're my third cousin through the seventh aunt, you know, what is your relationship to grandma? it's really these very which for the average person and your average listener, for me even, quite honestly, it's irrelevant. I leave that to, that's for Grand Lodge officers to worry their heads about. That's above my concern.
Of course, I'm a Southerner, so I understand things like third cousins twice removed very well.
Right, and that's the kind of stuff you get into. And like, you know,
I must add that I don't particularly care about that, but I do understand it from my upbringing. And, you know, in my world, the family was of very great importance. So let's move on. I would like to talk, I'm not talking so much about masonry in the present and masonry since the 18th century, because its underpinnings and its foundational beliefs are so much older. And this gap, huge gap of time, is always fascinating to me. Because, you know, Giordano Bruno was never no Mason. There was no indication of anything like that in his world. And yet, there is somebody in the very distant past who's terribly important, not to Masonry, but to alchemy and to all esoteric traditions in the Western world, and that's Hermes Trismegistus. And can you talk a little bit about who he may have been? If he even existed, I mean, he's like Pythagoras, who may or may not have actually even existed. And there are plenty of people who say that Jesus was an esoteric figure, but not an actual person. Talk to us a little bit about him, Hermes Trismegistus.
Well, Hermes, of course, is the Greek messenger of the gods, and he is thrice great. And thrice great has different interpretations. But again, we see the number three again. And generally speaking, that has to do with a cosmological view of there being the physical world, a kind of astral world, and then this vast, pure cosmological world from which all things came. So we have a pure upper world from which then emanates the various psychic and physical dimensions which we experience and inhabit. Okay. So he is master of all these things. He's master of these domains. That's maybe the easiest way to think of it. And he is, during the Greco-Egyptian period, is associated with the Egyptian god Tahuti or Thoth. And of course, most of your listeners will recognize who Thoth is. And he is the Egyptian god of writing, or the scribes, who wrote down the words of Ptah in 42 books. Of course, 42 has its own numerological meaning, but for the Egyptians, it also meant like, hey, you know, thousands and thousands. How many books did you write? I don't know. I wrote maybe a couple hundred, you know, something like that. It was an infinite number.
You're actually in that direction yourself.
I think I may hit 42 before I check out. Yeah, there's a possibility of that. I got two or three more coming out next year. I just lose track. But you know, you're no slouch yourself there. You've got quite a few.
That's right. My fingers fly.
That's right. We just sit down and buzz this stuff out. They don't pay us enough for what we do in 15 minutes or less. Yeah, so it's he's the master of writing, and writing is, of course, symbolic. It's hidden. Not everyone was literate. So words are magic, and magic is in writing, and this is how it all ties in. And then, of course, from that is the conveyance of knowledge, because that knowledge is knowledge of medicine, knowledge of arts, knowledge of the sciences of the time. All of this is hinged around the ability to read and write for preservation, and then also to act upon. So Hermes is associated with the Egyptian god of magic, and this survives in the Greco-Egyptian period and the Greco-Roman period. We see Hermes and Moses being said to be contemporaries during the Middle Ages. We even have pictures of Hermes being painted in some of the rooms of the papal palaces in Rome. So he was always part of that Western aspect of culture as a magical, instructive, educational figure. And then, of course, during the Renaissance, which really, the Renaissance is magic. Yes. The Renaissance is the translation of the Corpus Hermeticum, those small, thin volumes of works attributed to Hermes Trismegistus, in which, in classical style, he has a dialogue with his son and reveals the last surviving aspects of ancient wisdom. And with that is an explosion, a rebirth of what? Not just art and science, but classical art and science, which everyone knew linked us all back to Egypt. Because as the Egyptians said of the Greeks, you were but children when we were already old men. So
yes,
there we have that connection of Hermes, Lord of magic, Lord of light, as a figure of divine revelation.
You know, the book is full, folks, of really good lessons, I guess you would be best way to describe them, that will take you through the nature of esoteric and give you an understanding of esoteric masonry that's quite unlike anything I've ever read before, in that the older texts are mostly hard to reach in the sense of the way they're written. And of course, when you get to alchemy, then you really are. And I'm not saying that, I'm not drawing a connection here, but there is one, obviously. Alchemical texts are just notoriously obscure. I haven't met many alchemists who actually could understand them. But I want to talk in terms of initiation now, and what Masonic initiation is in the, and you have it in chapter 3, Masonic initiation and the Blue Lodge. And now, to say someone is seeking to become part of spiritual masonry or esoteric masonry, they've joined a lodge and they're beginning to find, perhaps within the lodge, but depending on where they are, maybe in another way, a journey into the more spiritual level of it. And what is the Blue Lodge?
It is the foundational Masonic experience. It's the cornerstone of all Masonic membership.
Okay.
There is nothing above Blue Lodge, even though we talk about fourth degree and fifth degree and 32nd degree. Those are considered explanatory, exploratory elaborations upon everything that goes on in the first 3 degrees. And while there is some truth to that, it is simply a way of saying, because someone is all Master Masons are equal, and anyone who has degrees above a Master Mason is still a Master Mason, therefore they are not superior in any way to their fellow brethren. So that's a kind of an equalizing effect that needs to be understood. People don't understand the degrees often. They're explanatory, they're elaborations. And again, let me go back to Pike. I think Pike did a spectacular job of trying to infuse them with tremendous philosophical and spiritual value as well. So you petition a lodge, your petition is balloted upon. That's where we hear the famous black ball statement. And if there's no black balls, you are allowed in. After the committee of investigation, of course, comments prior to the vote. A committee of investigation is two or three men who will visit you at your house. They'll take a look around. They're not going to explore your bathroom, but they're going to sit with you, and they're going to talk to you about what is involved, and talk to your spouse to find out, you know, so that they understand what's involved, so that this does not in any way infringe upon your obligations. Masonry is not meant to cause problems in a household. So if it's a problem for you being out one or two nights a month, then Masonry is not for you. So they need to make this clear and understand what are your reasons for joining. I've often sat on committees of investigation where I've had guys lie to me. I mean, the only reason they were joining is to get to the golf course, because we have a very nice golf course out here. Okay. And it's a Shriner golf course. And I would say, well, I'm not going to vote on this guy. He's not telling me the truth. I know that. Then of course you have to make sure that there's no mercenary or pecuniary motives. That you're joining of your own free will and accord, that you want to do this. No one's forcing you in any way. And, you wait. Now in Europe, it may take 6 months to a year before you get balloted upon. They really watch you carefully. Here, unfortunately, for better or worse, we do it a little more quickly. We also have the 1 day classes, which are a bit of a problem for some members. There's some, I find them to be mixed. We've gotten very good members from them. Others don't like them. They prefer the traditional way. But you say your ballot is approved, then you'll be notified and you'll have your first initiation, and that's going to be entered apprentice. And that is going to be the one that I guarantee you every member remembers for the rest of their lives. I have talked to men, and they still remember that initiation. It is powerfully overwhelming and impressive. Now, each jurisdiction does it slightly differently because they have slightly different rituals. But there's basic things that will be the same throughout, as I said, landmarks, that I would recognize. So when I was presenting in Washington, D.C. at a lodge down there, there are things that they do that we don't do in Pennsylvania, but there were things which they do which I recognized. And the same would be the case elsewhere. Then you would have some things to memorize and learn afterwards, and probably anywhere from 1 to 2 months afterwards, you would receive your fellow craft degree, some things to memorize as well, and then you would receive your Master Mason's initiation, which again is the one which is probably the most esoteric and most involved in symbolism, even in its most simple form, that many people will remember forever. It's also, unfortunately, the one which has been most prone to some kind of sophomoric abuses.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there are aspects of the degree which are very important, but depending on who's performing it, it's, you know, they can make too much of a almost a joke out of some very critical parts if they're not well learned in the degree and its meaning.
Yeah, the part of that's right. I understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like the part of the three ruffians where the fellow is roughed up,
Yeah, and they make that sort of into like a frat initiation.
Right, right. And that's where you see some of the jokes. I mean, I remember even in the 20s or 30s, I remember seeing it. And it was kind of funny. It was they actually were producing these goats, you know, they say, you're going to ride the goat, you know, that kind of stuff. And they actually had goats on wheels, you know, like a child would ride, like a bicycle, you know, and make jokes out of it. That's not appropriate. And I stress that, you know, that is a degrading of the mystery, a true degrading of the mystery that must be eliminated at all costs. That's where the fraternalism part becomes too strong. Remember, Masonry is based on fraternity, charity, and philosophy. And we're an extremely charitable organization. Over $1 million a day is donated by Masonic charities in the United States alone. Masonic Children's Hospitals, of which the Shriners are the principal supporter of, support children free of charge. They were even sued by the insurance companies for that and forced to bill. From what I understand, they do not collect that bill. Okay. So tremendous charitable work is done by Masonry. However, we lost philosophy along the way. And when you lose that philosophical view, it's very, and you're opening the doors too widely, it's a bit easy for some of that sophomoric stuff to creep in. And it's not widespread, but I've seen enough of it where it's not healthy for the link, for the strength of the organization, because they want it to have, become a good time. Well, we're here to have a good time. You know, we're here to have a good time. Yes, we are, but we don't need these rituals to have a good time. These rituals have meaning. These rituals have purpose. And fortunate, we have the Masonic Revival Movement. We have the traditional observance lodges. We have the philosophical lodges, which the young men are flocking to. And that's reinvigorating the movement tremendously in the United States.
Now, we're coming up toward the end of the show, and I am certain that, like me, many of my viewers have seen the symbol in the circle behind your head on your bookcase. Now, for our listeners, can you describe it and then tell us what it is? Go ahead and lean to the side a little bit so we can all see. Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Okay, well, that is the Hebrew letter Aleph, and has many meanings, but in this instance, it is the primordial beginningness. It's
beginningness, yes.
The point within the circle, the beginningness of expansion from this, you know, you notice it looks kind of like it's in motion. Sometimes you see it connected to the swastika. It is movement. So it is the, from that origin, that point of origin, the first movement, the first being comes, the first cause comes, all the secondary causes. And from, of course, at this point is the creation of the elements. So this is undifferentiated beingness.
The Hebrew alphabet and the Hebrew language have an enormous amount of esoteric, I would say, significance. The encoded into the Bible and also very much part of Masonry. Can just at the end, as we come to the end, can you tell us a little bit about the significance of that alphabet?
Well, the alphabet has 22 letters, three mother, which represent three elements of earth, air, and fire. Excuse me, air, water, fire, excuse me. And then seven simple letters, or 12 simple letters, and seven double. The seven represent the planetary energies, and the double the energies of the zodiac. And that's a general way to look at it. And of course, there's multiple aspects to these, and there isn't always agreement on what they represent. Different schools of Kabbalah have different views. Remember, they weren't communicating with text message or fax machines or PDF files. You know, things are being written down over generations, and different philosophical views arose because of different experiences. These are esoteric or metaphysical experiences that people are having, and then they're trying to codify them into a pattern so that others can understand them and hopefully replicate them. That's very important to understand. So there's often sometimes differences between them. And within Freemasonry, because we're dealing with the Temple of Jerusalem, there is a connection, whether Masons recognize it or not, to some aspects of Jewish Kabbalah or Jewish mysticism. And those who pay careful enough attention to the writings of Albert Pike, or even in the Northern jurisdiction, to the ritual monitors which they're given, and read the notes at the back of those ritual monitors, will see very specific references in many of the degrees to the meanings of Hebrew letters, Jewish mysticism, alchemy, and other esoteric ideas. So it is there. It's often in plain sight, hidden in plain sight, and people often miss it, Masons included. But within the framework of Kabbalah, Kabbalah became the principal framework sometime during the Renaissance for expressing Western esoteric ideas and cosmology. It's not the only one, but it became one of the primary ones. And part of that was an attempt to Christianize Jewish mysticism. They believe that through the Holy Upper Trinity, and this is primarily the writings of Reuchlin, that Johannes Reuchlin, that we saw a metaphysical demonstration of the Trinity from which all other things arose. And that's where we get into the Tree of Life.
And that is where we also end the show. It's a perfect moment of inflection to end and of reflection. The path of Freemasonry, the craft is a spiritual practice, Mark Stavish and his blog, Vox Hermes, which you can find by Googling it. I'll Google his name. I would like to thank you for a really fascinating discussion on Dreamland. And I do hope to have you back again when you publish another book, which presumably will be in a few weeks. Okay. Thank you so much for being with us, Mark.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.